Thanks, Charlie. Awesome. Great. Good morning, guys. It's so good to see all of you guys here today. I want to thank my wife for that whole setup up there. She did not only all of that, but she packed all of these packets too. So that was awesome. Yeah. Thanks, Charlie. Charlie and his wife, Virginia, are going to be, they're the ones you saw when you came in. They'll be available to you during the breaks and afterwards to talk or to pray. And also, if you'd like to schedule a counseling appointment with me, my card's in the packet. And so just contact me and we'll set up counseling. The average length of time that a couple goes through an issue before they get counseling is 6 years. So if you get kind of waiting about that long or even longer, you're about average. So don't worry about it. Just make that call. Like daytime TV, make the call. So one of the reasons we wanted to do this seminar was to be able to reach some of those couples who maybe haven't gotten any counseling, or just cover some things that you might be going through ahead of time. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And our thought was it's better to put fences around the top of the cliff than run ambulance services at the bottom. And we do in counseling run ambulance services a lot at the bottom. And that's great because we absolutely love helping couples. But we thought if we could do this in a larger group and do some of those prevention things, that would be really helpful. And then just to make our marriages better. So we're going to be covering a lot of the most common problems in marriage that we've seen in our 28 years of marriage counseling. We've kind of condensed it down. But before we get into that, I want to introduce my lovely wife, Lindsay. There she is. She's, put your raise up your hand. That's Lindsay. And we've been married for 34 years, held together by my animal magnetism. Lindsay was my girlfriend for 2 years before we got married. I didn't kiss my wife until the day we got married. I kissed my girlfriend a lot during those 2 years, but I didn't kiss my wife until the day we got married. We have one daughter who's Chloe, and some of you met her. I'm a pastor here and at Calvary Chapel Pacific Hills. I'm also a chaplain for the fire department. It's good to see some of our firemen here with their wives as well. Welcome, guys. And it's great to see all you guys. And we have couples here in every stage, boyfriend, girlfriend, engaged, couples who've been married longer than Lindsay and I have. And so that was what this conference is for everybody just to learn. And it's helpful stuff in just relationships in general, not just in marriage. And the earlier you learn these principles, you know, the better off we are. And it's never too late to learn them. But aren't you glad that you already found someone? Isn't that nice? It is so tough to find someone out there. You have to go online and all these dating apps and, you know, 35% of marriages now originate online. And a girl in our church was showing my wife and I an app called Bumble. And it's where you find people to date and, you know, you swipe and you have to, on Bumble, you know, the girls have to contact the guys first and then the guys are allowed to contact her in return and kind of, you know, see if it's a match. But, you know, the guys, they use a lot of humor to kind of, you know, get the attention of the girl. That's how guys meet girls, I guess, on these apps is using humor. Some of them are pretty funny. She was showing us some of them. One of them was an Asian guy, and he said, "Just escaped from North Korea, y'all." One of them said, "I smell amazing, and my Uber score is 4.8. Another one said, "I'm in my mid-30s, and I'm on Bumble, so everything's going according to plan." We have one girl who goes to church, and she actually put her mom on eHarmony without her mom even knowing about it and was answering back the guy. And her mom caught her. And she's like, "What are you doing?" You know? She goes, "Well, he's got a boat." So she actually set her mom up. That guy didn't work out, but with another guy on eHarmony, with her knowledge, looking over her shoulder. And now they're engaged. That's pretty cool. They're not here, but anyway, I won't say her name to protect her identity. But you would think she's like a junior in high school. She actually is married with two kids, the girl who did that. So just looking out for mom, you know. But we've been at this church for 15 years before we were pastoring a church in Kentucky. And we moved here originally back to Orange County to oversee the marriage ministry and the youth ministry. where when we were pastoring the church in Kentucky, that was a little easier there because the marriage ministry is the youth ministry in Kentucky. Maybe you've seen that bumper sticker. My wife is an honor student at Lincoln High School. We love the people. They're so authentic. But boy, was it a cultural change. We had one guy that wanted to be buried in his four-wheel drive truck because it ain't never been in a hole it couldn't get out of. We had venison in the potluck, camouflage Bible cover, deer herd over the podium, galvanized wash tub for a baptismal. When we first started, our favorite verse was, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst." After we grew, Calvary Chapel wanted to split up all the churches and on two lists. There was a home fellowship list and a church list. And you had to have at least 50 people in your church to be on the church list. And we're like, oh, we do not want to be on the home fellowship list. We want to be in the churches. We had 49 people in the church, but one gal had a split personality, so we counted her twice. But we love being back here in Southern California, helping marriages. In this first session, all you'll need is your notepad, as Charlie said. You could take notes. You could write down any questions, and there's a basket back there. Just pop them in there. And during the second session, when we go over all the tools, we'll answer your questions then. And starting off, I want to talk about the largest study ever done on marriage. It's been going for 40 years now, almost 40 years, and they've studied 4,000 couples. And it's been taking place up at the University of Washington, and they've teamed up with UC Berkeley. And they have been studying them in a scientific way. John Gottman, the leader of the study who got all these grants to be able to do this, was a mathematician at MIT. And he's an expert on how to do research. And so a lot of other studies in marriage, they do it by surveys. You know, you fill out, you check boxes and things. This study is unique in that it was all done by observation. So they had scientists observing these couples. They have like this kind of like a bed and breakfast up in Seattle. And the couples stay there for 24 hours at a time. And they're invited. They could bring their dog. They could bring their food with them. And they just hang out in this, they call it a lab. But it's like a bed and breakfast. And they have cameras on the walls. And they have halter monitors on their bodies. And they measure their heart rate. And they have little microphones. And everything is recorded. And so for their privacy, they recorded it from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And they didn't do any recording in the bathroom. But other than that, everything was recorded, every conversation. And these couples were observed. And not only were they observed, but they were tracked. In other words, the couples that stayed together and were happy, they called those the masters. And then the couples that stayed together and were unhappy or got divorced, they called those the disasters. And they looked at the footage, and they didn't know anything about marriage before they started this study. They didn't have any preconceived ideas. It was simply firsthand observation. Everything had to be scientifically proven when they did make any discoveries. And they discovered things in the disasters that were harmful. And then they also discovered things in the masters that were helpful in their relationship, but they started documenting those things. And everything they found also happens to match exactly what the Bible says about what to do in a marriage and what the Bible says not to do in a marriage. So it's pretty interesting. When I found out this study years ago, I discovered things right off the bat. I'm like, babe, we got to get these things out of our marriage because they prove that the things that they discovered, and I'll get to those in a moment, the four horsemen, for instance, are 94% fatal to the marriage. In other words, the marriages that had these four things in them were 94% failure rate. So I'm looking at that going, okay, we got to get these out of our marriage. But I started to get intrigued and interested in this study because, you know, when I became a pastor, I started having people, you know, book appointments to help their marriage. And, you know, and we had been married for 7 years before I became a pastor. I was a rescue boat captain in the Harbor Patrol. And I didn't know anything about counseling and marriage, you know. So I didn't get that much training in the school of ministry on that, a little bit, but not much. And so I had all these people. So I started to research and read books and listen to tapes and so that I could get tools to help people. And this was one of these tools that I discovered after we'd been married for a while. And I was glad I found it because it's helped our own marriage quite a bit. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But they found in the study, they found that there was a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative things in the masters. In other words, these, the good group, the healthy group, they would say there was 5 positive things for every 1 thing negative that was said. You know, the positive stuff, you know, showing interest, asking questions, being nice to one another, being kind, being affectionate, being empathetic. And then they saw, you know, as far as the negative stuff, criticism, hostility, anger, hurt feelings. So there's a 5-to-1 ratio. So if you do something negative to hurt your partner's feelings, you have to do something positive to make up for it. So the negative stuff, in other words, they found out has a lot more ability to do damage than positive stuff does to heal. And so you need to offset it. The disasters had about a 1-to-1 ratio of positive to negative things in all of their conversations. So for a relationship to feel right, it has to have a climate of affection, humor, fun, intimacy, and empathy. And, you know, you might want to declare war on all negativity when you learn about that research, but actually, eliminating anger, sadness, hurt feelings. It turns out that those negative things are actually productive in a relationship. You know, it calls out stuff that's not working. You know, you hurt your partner's feelings, you learn something, and you talk about it, and you learn not to do it again to each other. And also, for instance, Paul in the New Testament says to the Ephesians, he says, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath." Another translation says, "Don't sin by letting anger control you." That's what another translation says. So for a relationship to not have any negativity or sadness or anything, it wouldn't be very real. That's just part of it. When you get together with someone, you inherit everything. You inherit all the emotions, all the positive and the negativity with that. And there's a cycle. So you get closer and you draw apart. You get in a fight, you feel distant for a while, and then you get back together, you feel closer again. And also what they discover is that because of negativity in the relationship, there needs to be a continual renewing of the courtship. In other words, going out and just dating and having that relationship to recover from the negativity. So we don't want to get rid of all that. We just want to make sure it's handled correctly, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So they knew they were onto something when they discovered that there was a 5-to-1 ratio of positive and negative things in the masters and a 1-to-1 ratio of positive and negative things in the disasters. Okay. So the second question they asked was, are all negative things equally corrosive, or are some things worse than others? And that's when they discovered 4 things that were present in the disasters but absent in the masters. And these 4 things they nicknamed the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. That's the name that they came up with this. And why? Because it brings destruction in its wake. And that's what I want to talk about today is the first one is criticism. Now, this is defined as it's a way of complaining that suggests that your partner's personality is defective. All right. So like, let's say this is a problem in the relationship. The healthy couples would take the problem and they would bounce it around between the two of them. The unhealthy couples would take the problem and they would embed it into their partner and they'd say, "You're the problem. There's a personality defect in you, and that's why we're having this problem." They make the issue, whatever it is, just a symptom of the defect of their partner. So, criticism is a way of complaining that suggests that your partner's personality is defective. Example, you always talk about yourself, you're so selfish. That would be a classic example of a criticism. Rather than complaining about your spouse's actions, you criticize him or her. If I wanted to complain in a healthy way, I would say something like, "You talked about yourself all through dinner. You never asked me about my day. That hurt my feelings. I need you to ask me about my day." In an unhealthy way, they would explain it like this: "You talked about yourself all through dinner. You never asked me about my day. What's wrong with you?" So when you say, "What's wrong with you?" that's a classic criticism that the disasters would use. They're talking about the problem and making it the result of the defect of their partners. Here's a list of criticisms. You don't care. All you think about is yourself. Your family's like that. You're like that too. You're spoiled. You never have anything nice to say. You just like to give me a hard time. Now, criticisms are a short hop over from complaining. Yet they're very different because complaining is actually healthy in a marriage. They dispelled a lot of rumors and myths about marriage also in the study. That couples that fight a lot get divorced or are not happy. Not true. It's actually how you fight. That's the key. And if you do it, you know, in a healthy way. So expressing anger and things that you're not happy about, it's not pleasant to do, but it actually makes the marriage healthier in the long run. And we're not supposed to suppress our anger, but manage it in such a way. Like Paul told the Ephesians, be angry and sin not. In other words, the anger is actually a helpful thing to have to be able to get stuff out to deal with it. But you don't want to do it in such a way that is destructive to the relationship. And we'll parse that out for you. And I think you'll have a pretty good idea when we're done of this. So one of the clues that Jesus taught us about this is he said, if another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses it, you've won that person back, Matthew 18:15. So he's saying to point out the offense. In other words, the action. You don't go after someone personally. You don't say, you know, the way you are bothers me. You say what you did or what you said bothers me. You stick to the offense, to the action. So what they discovered was that the healthy couples actually talked about what was bothering them, and they asked for their needs to be met. The unhealthy couples just said what they thought was wrong with their partner. And there's some other things that we'll see as well. But basically, Jesus is saying, don't judge people. Deal with what they did that upset you. And criticism involves attacking someone's personality or character rather than a specific behavior. And so the trouble begins, though, when your complaints go unheeded or if you never really express them, and then your spouse just repeats them, and then they pick up steam, and then when you talk, it can come out in a barrage of grievances. You begin blaming, and you're beginning critical of their personality rather than the specific deed. Or if you stifle a complaint, and one day it explodes in a whole barrage of criticism. But the tools that we're going to give you today are going to give you an opportunity to complain in a healthy way, and that gives you a way to be able to deal with your grievances so you don't have to stuff them. You actually have a way to communicate them that's healthy, and it actually works. It works actually really well. So criticism involves blaming, making a personal attack or an accusation, while complaint is just something, it's a comment about something I wish were otherwise. In other words, that's what a complaint is. I wish this were different. And so I'm going to talk about that. So criticisms begin many times with you. Complaints begin with the letter I, the pronoun I. Now, I'll read to you a complaint and a criticism. And they're basically saying the same thing, but they're worded differently. I wanted the laundry to be finished by now so I could get to the mall before it closes. That's a complaint. This is the same thing, but in a criticism form. You should have finished the laundry by now. You know I want to get to the mall today. That's a criticism. It may seem like splitting hairs, but when you're on the receiving end of a criticism, it feels a whole lot worse than being on the receiving end of a complaint. And sometimes when we were learning these, we're like, okay, that just didn't feel right what you said. And we don't know why. Let's kind of think that through. Oh yeah, it's got those ingredients in it. Okay, let's just take that out and then we'll just learn to say that differently. So criticisms are, you don't care, you always put yourself first, you're the type of person who always finds fault. One form of criticism is passing judgment on your mate. You know, you should have been ashamed for the things you said to him, or you should know better than to leave the porch light on all night, and you should know better than to not put the coffee grounds down the sink. It's that wagging finger that's that scolding. Those are forms of criticism. Another form of criticism is to bring up a long list of, even if they're technically complaints, to bring a long list. That's called kitchen sinking. That's when you haven't had a chance to talk, you haven't gotten their attention, but all of a sudden you do, and you get this chance, and you just bring it all up at once. And that's, even though they're technically complaints, it's so overwhelming and pervasive, it'll feel like criticisms because you can't process it. You know, I don't feel listened to you by now. You don't touch me very often. I asked you to do certain chores, and you didn't. I'm just not having any fun. You know, that's just going to like overload you, and you're not going to be able to, you know, go anywhere with that. So another form of criticism is accusing your partner of betraying you. I trusted you to balance the checkbook, and you didn't. I just can't trust you, can I? You know, you betrayed me. So complaints don't finger the spouse as a culprit. What they do is they're an expression of things that you just wish were different in life or in your relationship. And that's actually a really good, healthy thing to do. Unlike complaints, criticisms, or generalizations, you never and you always, those are criticisms. Those are harmful things to do. And I know it takes a while to get them out, but if you work on it just a little bit, these actually, you can totally, you know, we still mess up all the time, but we don't mess up as much as we used to. But it's amazing. And then you start to figure out why. You're like, wait a minute. If she says to me, well, you never have done that, I'm going to spend like a half hour trying to convince her of the one time I did it. So am I being empathetic toward her? Is she getting her needs met? No, she just shot herself in the foot by saying that because I fell right into the trap and then we're going around and around. But if she were to say, and now we catch ourselves. So if one of us says that, the other person will fall into it for a while and then start to like prove her wrong or prove him wrong. And all of a sudden we go, wait a minute, we fell into it. Okay, hold on, regroup. Okay. Wow, so you feel like I haven't done that. That must be a bummer not to have ever had that need be met. Or let's talk about that. And then you recover. And so it's just good to be aware of these things. And you'll see a huge improvement in your relationship when you're just at least aware of them. So just remember, you're the one, if you use them, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're not getting your own needs met by doing that. You're short-circuiting the situation. So a complaint is a specific statement of anger or displeasure or distress or other negativity. I'm upset that you didn't talk about how my day went, but just talked about yourself all through dinner. That's simply a complaint. Criticisms are a lot less specific. They're global. They've got blaming in it. You never show any interest in me or my work. You just don't care about me. A complaint is attacking a specific action or lack of action. Criticizing is attacking the person. Now, here's another couple examples. We don't go out as much as I'd like to. That's a complaint. That's healthy. That's good. Or you never take me anywhere. That's a criticism. Another one, upset me when I came home and there were dirty dishes in the sink. This morning we agreed that you would wash them. Complaint. Criticism, you left dirty dishes all over the kitchen again. You promised me you wouldn't. I just can't trust you, can I? Criticism. I expect you to come home. And this one's a complaint. I expect you to come home right after work. When you didn't, it made me feel like you care more about going out with your friends than spending time with me. Second one, same thing, but just reworded differently. I hate that you're the type of person who never thinks to call and tell me you'll be late coming home. You always leave me hanging. You care more about your friends than you do about our marriage. That second one's a criticism because you're telling them what they believe. You care more about, you know, your mind reading, you're judging them, you're saying what they are inside and what makes them tick. The other one, in the complaint version of that, it's like, I feel like you care more about your friends than you do about our marriage. That's totally legit because you're just talking about how you feel. The other one is like what you were expecting. Well, gosh, I expected this, and that's why I'm upset, because this is what I was thinking and expecting. And when it didn't happen, you know, it made me feel this way. In other words, you stick to, you did this, and that makes me feel this way. Or, you know, I was expecting this, and it didn't happen, and I feel like this right now. That's really healthy to do that. But to just tell them, oh, you're the type of person, you know, who never thinks to call, that's like totally judging them. It's like, oh yeah, I know your kind. I know what you're made of. I've seen you before. You know, I've seen your type around, you know, that kind of a thing. And it's common to slip into complaints to criticism. And we'll see this in a lot of different relationships. Once you start to look for these things, you'll see them. They're the bosses who say, you don't focus enough on your work, instead of saying your memo wasn't detailed enough. Or, you know, you're just not capable of, or the spouses say, you're just not capable of keeping the bathroom clean, are you? Instead of saying, could you put the lid on the toothpaste, please? You know, there's a difference there. One of them's action-based, the other one is personality-based. Now, with respect to our relationship with God, I feel free to complain to God. He actually invites me to do that. But if I criticize God, that would hinder my relationship with God. And it doesn't feel right. But I do have a freedom to complain to him. And because, you know, that actually is a sign of faith. Because think about it, we only express our feelings to someone to the extent that we trust them. So if God's inviting me to trust him with all of my feelings, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you, and if I give him the positive and the negative and tell him how I feel and what I need, that's actually trusting him. That's faith, and that impresses him, and that's the one thing he really is impressed by and that he wants for us to do. And so if you think about it, same thing in your relationship. You're actually trusting that person if you're telling them what you need and what's bothering you. It's a sign of trust in the relationship, just like it is a sign of trust in God. Now, the classic example of this is in the story of Job. Satan came to the throne of God and said, hey, there's a servant Job, you know, he's a really good guy, he hates evil, loves good, you know, good family man, takes care of his family, and then Satan's like, if you let me put the hurt on him, he will criticize you, because he's only happy because you give him all this stuff. You let me take some of his stuff away, and he'll criticize you. And so God's like, okay, go for it. And so he pulls out his protection from him and lets him afflict him. Yet Job passed the test, it says, because he didn't criticize God. He complained to God about what he wished were different, but he never criticized God. And there's a huge difference there. And he passed the test, came out with an A+. And that's kind of the core of what we're talking about here. It's an example. And in fact, all the great people in the Bible, they complained to God about what was bothering them, and they asked for their needs to be met. Just like all these people in this study, the healthy couples did that. And they also gave bits of admiration and appreciation to each other, the healthy ones did in this study. And if you look back over the people in the Bible, they talked about what's bothering them, and they gave God bits of admiration and appreciation, and they asked for their needs to be met. So it's kind of a standard for healthy relationships. And even the Apostle Paul says, you know, I know in whom I have believed and I'm persuaded he's able to keep, but I haven't trusted him until that day. And so we're supposed to, you know, be anxious for nothing, but in all things, you know, positive and negative, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus our Lord. So we're supposed to, you know, let him have all of our feelings, good and bad, and ask him for help. And so the Bible encourages us to have a consistency between our relationship with God and the relationship with others. If anyone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar, 1 John 4:20. So this consistency of God to others is kind of God breaking us in and how to have a relationship with him, and then it forms to how to have a healthy relationship with others because they're the same. This, all the same principles apply. And we love each other because he first loved us. And so Jesus teaches us a lot of helpful things about a relationship. For instance, he says, judge not that you be not judged, you know, and criticism actually has judgment in it. And so, you know, he's showing us how to handle relationships. And that's interesting, judge not that you be not judged, because whatever you dish out, you get back in return, right? If you're an encouraging person, you encourage people, you get a lot of encouragement in return. If you serve others, you'll get a lot of joy in return for serving others, for volunteering, for helping. You put one seed in the ground, you get a bunch of seeds back in return. If you sow, you reap more, right? If you sow criticism, you'll get a whole bunch of criticism right back at you. And that's what we've noticed, is that when we would criticize each other less, we would get less back in return. And if we just simply complain, you don't get any criticism in return. You actually get a response that's helpful. Most people want to be helpful. And if you say, God, this is really bothering me, you know, and I need this, and when you do this, you know, that bothers me, and I need this instead. Most people are like, oh, okay, well, thanks for telling me. In fact, Paul says to speak the truth in love. That's what Apostle Paul said. Now, when someone criticizes me, I feel like they're telling me the truth. But when someone complains to me, I feel like they're telling the truth in love. And I like that better. You know, everybody does. I don't know of anybody that would prefer the other way. And but you know what's interesting is that TV and movies, they criticize each other, and then it has a good outcome. You know, they'll full on do this, and then it turns out good. Like, wow, thanks for telling me the truth, and they actually end up in a better relationship. That's not the way it is in real life, absolutely not. And I think that's one of the places where we get these bad habits from, is TV, movies. I think maybe the way we were brought up, watching other people, and we just didn't know any different. You know, we didn't. But when you know better, you do better. And when we learn these things, you know, things got a lot better. And in my 28 years of marriage counseling, I got to tell you, these are one of the most common problems that couples do in their marriage and in their relationships. And they just don't have a different way to go. But once you learn this, you start to apply it. You're like, wow, this stuff really works. And so treat others the way you want them to treat them is basically what the Bible says. So how do you avoid criticism? How do you avoid these things? Well, first of all, remove the blame from your comments. So if you got a gripe, you're going to go, okay, I got to take the blame out of it. The second thing, say how you feel. Got to say how I feel. The third thing is don't criticize your partner's personality. Fourthly, don't insult, mock, or use sarcasm. Fifth, be direct. Sixth, stick with one situation. And then lastly, don't try to analyze your partner's personality. So if you have something that's bothering you, you just have to sit down for a moment and think about it and tweak it a little bit differently. Like, instead of saying, okay, I want to say you're so emotionally unavailable to me. Okay, that's not going to come out too good. Yeah, that would be a criticism. Okay, what do I need? Well, I'm getting that sinky, lonely feeling inside. That old feeling comes back of feeling lonely. And when we cuddle on the couch, that was really nice. I wonder how we can make that happen again. Okay, good. So you go to your spouse, you say, I'm feeling that old, sinky, lonely feeling again. And when we cuddled on the couch last week, that was really nice. How can we make that happen again? You'll get a great response. It'll be like right now, or tonight, whatever, But if you go, you're so emotionally unavailable to me, you're not going to get that good response. But it's amazing that you could go years doing the criticism part and wondering why it's never getting better. And then you just simply learn to say it differently and you get a 180-degree opposite response. You're like, why didn't I do this all along? It's just a habit. We all get in habits. We all just, get in the habit of doing the same thing. And there's other reasons that we'll talk about in a moment. Why people use the four horsemen. So the other thing too was that the masters had what was called a soft startup. In other words, they would come on slow and easy with their partner and they would use complaints. If you come in hard with criticisms, that's called a harsh startup. And that's what the disasters had. They had harsh startups. And the masters had soft startups. And they were absent of any criticisms. And the research proved that if a discussion starts off with a harsh startup, it will inevitably end on a negative note, even if there were lots of attempts to be nice in between. A harsh startup is doomed for failure. They would ask the couples, as part of the study, they would ask the couples to get together, and in this particular, they had a separate kind of room where they would put these couples together. And in that room, not only were they mic'd and had halter monitors and measured their heart rate, they actually tested their blood pressure, and they also, when they urinated, they tested their stress hormones, and they actually tested their blood for their immune system. And what they would do is they'd say, okay, talk about a problem that you have not been able to resolve yet. In other words, an unsolvable problem between you. And go ahead and talk about it. And they would give them 15 minutes. And 96% of the time, they were able to predict the outcome of that conversation based on the first 3 minutes of their discussion. So if you begin a discussion with a harsh startup, you might as well pull the plug, take a breather, and start over. Because it's not going to end well. So you just got to learn to take a break. But you know what? Most couples don't do that. They don't realize that that's what they need to do. But that's kind of the hard part sometimes is training yourself to take that break and to give each other that break. And the first time you do it, it feels weird to just walk away. But you're doing it in a healthy way. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. So for a relationship to feel right, they found out that it's got to have a rich climate of affection and humor and fun and empathy and intimacy. And the healthier couples, they talked about what was bothering them, and they asked for their needs to be met. So the second horseman, the first one's criticism. The second one is defensiveness. That's the second thing. And defensiveness is the natural outcome of criticism. So if you start criticizing your partner, naturally they're going to get defensive. And so you'll find that when you cut down on your criticism, you'll get a lot less defensiveness in return. And it almost like goes away completely, which is pretty cool. But if you are criticizing, or I should say, if you're seeing a lot of defensiveness, it's probably that you're criticizing. Because the criticizing actually brings all four of these horsemen into the marriage. They all come trotting right behind each other, right into the marriage. And so when you deal with the first one, it helps the second one. But just so that we can identify defensiveness, it basically wards off a perceived attack. So if you're being bombarded with insults, it's kind of a natural inclination to be defensive. And it's understandable. In fact, that's what's so dangerous about defensiveness, because you feel justified in doing it. You know, you feel like, wow, I kind of deserve to be this way because of how they're acting. But that in itself is actually destructive because you don't get anywhere. And you don't see anything wrong with it. The victim doesn't see anything wrong with it. And it can occur in response to contempt, criticism, or even complaints. And it shows itself in two ways. Righteous indignation, this is where you meet your partner's complaint or criticism with a counter complaint. Or you are a innocent victim. In other words, you act innocent. Well, I cared about your day. I really did. I was interested in your day. You know, you don't take responsibility. The master's accepted responsibility, even if it was for part of the problem. So like if a wife said to her husband, yeah, you talked about yourself all through dinner, but you never asked me about my day, the masters would say, good point. You know, I was pretty stressed out today at work all day, and even driving home, I was feeling stressed. I don't think I was listening to anybody talk. How was your day? The second one, form of defensiveness is denying responsibility. So if your partner criticizes you, like they say, the house is dirty, you respond, well, it's not your fault, you can't do everything. Or if your husband's bummed you for not laundering his clothes, you shoot back with, you never said you're going to. Or if your wife says you hurt her feelings with some comments you made at the party, you go, I didn't say anything wrong. Or you can make excuses. Your wife calls you a liar because you didn't tell her that you got a bonus at work, and your response was, well, if I told you, you'd just spend it all. When Don Shula was the coach for the Rams, there was a microphone that was accidentally left on, and he screamed a lot of profanities, and millions of fans were pretty offended, and they wrote in letters to him. And, you know, here's this guy that, you know, integrity and looked up to and everything. And every letter that had a return address, he wrote them a letter asking for their forgiveness. And he's going to try to do better next time. So there's two ways to get respect. You can act nobly, or you can admit it when you mess up. There's only two ways to keep that kind of thing going. Success is stumbling from one failure to failure to another failure with no loss of enthusiasm. And so stay enthusiastic. When you mess up, just get good at owning it up. But I'm telling you, when you have complaints or criticism come at you, that's the natural reaction, but at least you can know you can catch it. Cross-complaining, this is where you meet your partner's complaint or criticism with an immediate complaint of your own, completely ignoring what your partner said. So, Sue, we never have people over for dinner anymore. You're so antisocial. That's criticism, right? Bob, no, it's just that you never could clean up the place, so we could. I should have checked the registration list to make sure there was no like couples with Sue and Bob here. If you see a couple without a name tag on, that's probably Sue and Bob. They probably like ripped them off. We should have like door prizes for couples who inadvertently get called out for bad behavior because their names happen to be the same names as the couples in this study. These names were actually based upon real people, but they actually changed the names when they published this material and wrote these books. So pay no attention to the names. Jason, I don't like it that your sister comes over every Saturday. Amanda, well, I don't like it that you go to the gym every other night. Cross-complaining. Lauren and Steve fell in a cross-complaining trap when discussing his recent purchase of a gun without telling her. He knew guns upset her, and to make the matters worse, he kept the gun and the payments he made on it a secret for several months. Lauren, that really made me mad that you can keep a secret from me for that long. I thought we didn't have secrets. Steve, well, remember when you got the car seat? You hid that from me thinking I'd be unhappy till it was paid off. And then there's the, have you ever heard that playground saying, I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off of me and sticks to you? Well, in one move, you manage not only to defend yourself and then attack and blame your partner. So if your partner says that they found your party at the behavior rude, you counter with, well, I'm rude. You're the one that I can't even remember to send my mother a birthday card. Cross-complaining. in its most blatant form, Bob, you never help with the dishes. Sue, that's not true. You're the one that never helps. So, and it can get even trickier. For instance, this is Sarah and Carl discussing his drinking problem. Sarah, when you drink too much, you're just not sociable anymore. I feel separate from you. That's the part I fear. Carl, well, how about when you explode into a tantrum? Is that any different? Sarah, why are you asking me? Carl, because I want to know how you feel when it's in your court and not mine. So Carl is defending himself from attack by turning the tables on his wife. She's the one that's not sociable. And then there's yes, buddy. That's when you start off agreeing, but then you come back around and you disagree. And also, you know what? There's couples that are like attorneys with each other. They just argue, but they argue without using the four horsemen, and that's okay. I'm around couples, and I see couples where they're kind of competitive, and they just have a lot of fun, and they just really get into it. But they don't use the four horsemen. And when they do go too far, they do repairs. You know, this is stuff that where you just don't take any responsibility at all. That's what we're talking about here. So a yes but statement is where you start off agreeing, but then you end up disagreeing because you've got some morally justifiable reason for why you did it. And we see this in the scriptures too, like with Saul and Samuel. Samuel's calling Saul on these things, and then he never fesses up to it. He's a really good example about what it's like not to take responsibility. So Dan, you said you're going to fill up the gas tank, and you didn't. Ellen, well, yes, that's because I had to get home to make dinner for your parents. Melinda, once again, you let me down. You were supposed to pay the phone bill last week. Anthony, yes, so I was waiting for you to tell me you'd made a bank deposit first. Another one is repeating yourself. So rather than like attempting to understand your spouse's point of view, you just repeat your own position over and over again, rephrasing it. And if you say it loud enough and long enough, you think it's going to soak in. But it doesn't. Why? Why doesn't it ever soak in? It's because you didn't hear what they had to say first. There's a really interesting proverb that says, Proverbs 18:13, he who answers before he hears, it is counted folly and shame to him. So if you don't hear that person, then they're not going to hear you in return. And so, and I'm sure you've gone through this, and I've counseled a lot of couples where they just repeat each other back and it doesn't soak in. And, you know, because I think some people think it's a waste of time to try to understand your spouse, you know. But it's not. It's actually a waste of time not to understand and not to accept, because what happens is they're not going to accept you and what you have to say. So, in fact, in the New Testament, it says for husbands to live with their wives in an understanding way. Now, it doesn't say to understand them, so you don't have to, and you're not always going to, and you may not even most of the time, but in an understanding way. In other words, you just try to accept it and understand. So it's really helpful. So listen to Jonathan and Maria attempt to discuss whether he plays golf too often. Essentially, she keeps saying he does, and he keeps saying he doesn't, and they get nowhere. Maria, I think playing one day on the weekend is fine, but three or four nights a week is too much. Jonathan, well, that's not much. It's a minimum. Maria, well, not when you have two boys that need you home for dinner. Jonathan, well, I'd like to be home for dinner always, but if you play golf, you have to play regularly. Maria, well, you don't have to play three or four times, and then on the weekend, that's too much when you have a family. Jonathan, well, I have to play often, otherwise it's not worth playing at all, and I don't want to give up golf. So both of them are rephrasing and restating without paying an iota of attention about what the other person is saying. And they're hoping that if they say it loud enough and long enough, it's going to sink in, and it never, ever does. You'll go years with this and never get anywhere. And where did this start? Back in the Garden of Eden. They didn't take responsibility, and it's kind of plagued us ever since. So Jesus said, if another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses it, you've won that person back. The important thing is listen and let it sink in. And and sometimes you may have to do mirroring. So what you're saying is this. So let me see if I can hear this, understand this correctly. So what you're saying is this. It's a mirroring exercise where you repeat and rephrase what that person is saying so that they know that you've understood it and that you accept it. And you don't have to agree, but you've accepted it. That's huge, you know. Each couple reaches a huge milestone in their relationship when they realize it's okay for their partner to have their own perspective. Even though you totally disagree with it and you think it's wrong, but you allow them to have it. They're going to have their own perspective anyway, whether you allow them to have it or not. But at least if you accept it, then they feel accepted. One of our biggest psychological needs is to feel accepted. And when you allow your partner to have whatever perception, because perceptions are not right or wrong, they just are. But when you allow your partner to have their own perception, they feel accepted. And that's a wonderful stage in your relationship to get to, because then you can move on. Otherwise, you just, you know, and it's nice. I have some guys that went for years and they didn't know that they could or should do that. They just spent years trying to, you know, convince their wife that she was wrong about something. And then they just realized, wow, I can just let them have their own point of view. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It'll be way better for both of you. And guess what? She'll actually let you have your own point of view once you accept hers. In Romans 15, it says to accept one another just as Christ accepted you. Now, how do you allow someone to have their own point of view? Well, there's a difference between acceptance and approval. So you don't have to approve of what someone's doing or what they're saying, but you can accept them. And you can even accept their perception of what they're saying about that. So there's a huge difference. But a lot of people think, well, I have to approve of everything. I have to agree. No, you don't. You just have to accept them and what they're saying. And if you do that, that's a wonderful thing, because it's going to help your relationship. So there's a difference between acceptance and approval. And that frees you up to be able to accept more people when you don't have to go around and approve of everything. And the second thing is that there's a real big difference between resolution and reconciliation. Now, one of the things they discovered in this study is that 69% of conflicts in marriages are unsolvable. 69% of conflicts in marriages are unsolvable. We just learn to talk about them. So if your goal is to get resolution before you open up your heart, before you give any emotion, before you accept that person, then you're not going to get there 69% of the time. And there's going to be a lack of closeness. But if you say, you know what, let's reconcile. And we're going to reconcile this relationship without resolving it. Then it's a lower bar and it's easier to get to. And it's really important to do that. It was God's idea. He reconciled himself to us. And it's a wonderful thing. You're hugging it out and you're saying, you know what? You're more important to me than this problem. And I don't know if we're going to fix this. This could be one of the 69% that Ken was talking about. But we'll try and talk about this again, maybe tomorrow or set a time, whatever. But until we do, I just want you to know that I love you and that I accept you. And that I'm not going to let this problem come in between us. You are more important to me than this problem. And you hug it out and you clear the air. That's a reconciliation. Now, some people can even resolve things mentally and not even get to that. They won't even reconcile. They won't give open their heart. And you'll see this in the last Four Horsemen, which is stonewalling. I'll get to that in a moment. Stonewalling is an emotional withdrawal from conflict. And you don't want to get there either. That's the last Four Horsemen. But so reconciliation is a wonderful thing to do. And it's a good practice to get into where you feel reconciled, where you're like, you know what, you're agreeing to disagreeing together, basically without having the problem solved. And yet your heart is still open to each other. And that's a wonderful place to live. And, The next one is contempt. All right, that's the third horseman is disrespect. All right, contempt. That's where you feel like you're smarter, you're more punctual, you're cleaner, you're tidier. That's when you talk down to your partner. That's coming from a place of superiority when you talk down to them. That's the third. This is the most lethal out of the four. And that's associated with name calling. Contempt is one of the biggest predictors of divorce. How do you know it's contempt? They'll say something like, you're an idiot. Maybe that would be contempt. And you'll see this in movies, and it's not harmful. It actually helps the relationship. But in real life, it tears it apart. Maybe you're like, well, I just want to be brutally honest. Well, the problem with being brutally honest is a lot of people get more satisfaction out of the brutality than they do the honesty. Signs are name calling and that kind of thing. And it's good if you've got contempt in your heart to process it. You could process it in counseling alone. You can pray out loud with God. You could talk with someone else about it. You could journal how you feel. But it's important to not let your spouse get the rough draft of what you're thinking at that moment and to really calm down. Because what they discovered was that not one conflict was able to be resolved when the heart rate got above 100 beats a minute. They would play a trick on them. They'd wait till a couple's arguing. And then they had a read on their EKG, right? Their heart rate was being recorded. When they got above 100 beats a minute, they got into that fight or flight mode, which is where we get into when we get worked up. And that's maladaptive for conflict resolution. It's a great gift for like fleeing from a predator, you know, or jumping out of the way of a car coming, right? The fight or flight mode is really helpful. But for conflict resolution and interpersonal relationships, it's harmful. You'll never be able to resolve a conflict, and they proved this. What they did was they waited for the heart rate to get above 100 beats a minute when they were arguing, and they came out and they said, hey, would you mind not talking about this problem until we fix the equipment? The equipment's broken. The equipment was fine. What they did was they waited for them to get down to baseline, and they came back out and they said, okay, go ahead and resume talking about this problem, and they would fix the problem like that. But with the elevated heart rate, not one couple was ever able to fix a problem. So what you need to do then is, if you're feeling contempt, you got to process it individually, right? You don't want to let that fly because it's going to be harmful. But secondly, you got to give yourself a break. You got to go and get really good at taking a 15-minute break, go to the bathroom, go outside, go in the patio, go for a walk. Interestingly enough, though, the couples that got into a fight, some of them wouldn't let the other person go. Oh, you're not going to leave me. You're not going to abandon me. And they would stay and they'd get into a physical altercation. And then they put those in a separate group and studied them, the domestic violence couples. And one thing they learned in the domestic violence couples is that one person would not, there's always one person who would not let the other person leave. They would feel abandoned and they would stay and they would get into a fight. So it's really important to get good at leaving. Now, some people get really, like some couples would rather stay and actually get into a fist fight. And that's a more comfortable idea for them than to let the other person go, you know. But you just practice and get really good. You know, you just don't leave. You go, okay, I'll be back at 8 o'clock. I'll be back 30 minutes, you know, or have a code word or something where you just really get good at calming down. Because you're going to, and some people are like, well, if he left, I'd be too upset. Well, you're probably not going to resolve the conflict if you're that upset anyway. And I can guarantee you won't if you have an elevated heart rate and if you're in that fight or flight mode. So it's really important to learn to let the other person go. And so let's talk about stonewalling. This is an emotional withdrawal from conflict. This is the last of the four horsemen. This 85% of the stonewallers were men. And one of the things they realized was when they would get flooded, they would shut down kind of in a stonewalling mode. And, you know, their kind of the excuse was that, well, if I can't say anything good, I don't want to say anything at all. And so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. But what happens when you stonewall is that the person can't get through to you, right? And so they try a 60-pound cannon, that doesn't work. And they get an 80-pound cannon. And then they're pulling drastic measures to try to get a reaction from you. And then that in itself causes harm. So stonewalling is a harmful thing to do. And they prove that because, you know, the person's not, it's an icy disapproval. It's a, you feel shut out. There was a professor at Biola who showed this video clip in a class of a child, a one-year-old that was sitting in a high chair with his mom, just eating Cheerios, and he was just hanging out. And they did an experiment, and the mom just stared at the baby, the toddler, with a complete flat affect with no response. And the kid starts like squirming and then crying and then freaking out and just going completely, you know, crazy. And right at the 60-second mark, the mom snapped out of it. Oh, hi, honey, it's okay, it's me, I'm here, you know. And then the baby just calmed right down. So we don't do well when someone is stonewalling us. Now, taking that break to come back together to talk about it is not stonewalling. That's actually a really wise thing to do. But when you're together, if you're flooded, which means you just got a barrage of criticisms and all the, you know, kitchen sink, whatever, and you're overwhelmed. Because see, they showed that guys can't handle the conflict as quickly and easy as women do in the study, because their fight or flight mechanism kicks into gear and it affects them more in deeper ways. And they did this in another study where they would have these waiters set up, and the waiter would come up to the table and say something really rude to the couple. And the guy would get into fight or flight, and he would stay there for 20 minutes and he wouldn't relax until he could retaliate, you know, and get them back and say something to the waiter. The women, though, they would be angry at first, but then they would calm down. They would self-soothe faster. And so that's one theory about why women will bring up problems in the marriage more often than men will to address it. And men will avoid that because they know that they're instinctively, that their fight or flight mechanism is going to kick in and they're going to have a hard time dealing with it. And so that's why one reason why men stonewall is because, you know, they get flooded. And But just realize that the stonewalling action put to the other person is harmful in itself. And it's important to recognize, okay, there's a difference between reconciliation and resolution. And when you are there, it's better to leave and come back and than to just stay there and stonewall and to have let the four horsemen just kind of, you know, tear you apart. It's better to leave and come back. And that's a really important, helpful thing to do. And that's not stonewalling. That's actually a really wise thing to do, because you're not going to be able to fix it when you're just all, you know, in a raged. And it's that cooling off period. Very, 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 very smart to do. Wise couples do that. And if you do let your partner go in the backyard, don't sit there and text them every 5 minutes, you know, to try to get their attention. It's got to be like a legitimate separation to really calm. But guys may need more than 20 minutes, you know. Guys that actually have, they're just, that adrenaline actually takes a little bit of exercise to let it seep out of your body. But it's important to just go and journal or talk to a friend or pray out loud and get those things worked out. And you know what? You know, it's a really good thing to do too. If I had like 1 second to counsel a couple, I would say walk and talk. That's probably one of the best ways to resolve things. You're outside. You're not going to yell too loud because the neighbors will hear you while you're walking. You know, watch your Fitbit, stay below 100 beats a minute. And it's just something about that walking and talking. In fact, if you need to talk to a kid about something, a child, you'll want to do something when you're playing Legos or doing some activity. That's the best time to talk to a kid about something. And sometimes that's really good with the couples too. You're out walking and, you know, you don't cue off of each other's expressions. Like if you're sitting on the couch trying to talk about something, hey, you got that look. You're looking at me like that. I know what you know, and you're like, you know, you don't react off each other's facial expressions. There's outside, you're looking at different things, and it's like you're just distracted a little bit and it blows off a little bit of steam. So that's a really good thing to do. If nothing else works, try to walk and talk. Okay, guys. Let's take a 15-minute break, and then don't forget to put any questions in there, and then we'll come back and go over all the tools. Okay. I got some. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, guys. So I had a question during the break about the four horsemen and the implementation of those. What helped my wife and I was that we agreed on three things. We agreed that they were harmful, okay, because they're scientifically proven to be harmful. 94% harmful, you know, 94% of the couples that had those four things in their marriage failed. So we agreed that they're harmful. That's pretty easy to accept. Secondly, we agreed not to use them on each other. And then thirdly, and probably most helpfully, I don't think that's the word helpfully, but what was most helpful, and thirdly, is that we helped each other when we did use them on each other to point them out. And so we agreed to that they're harmful, that they're not to use them, and then to point them out in each other when they're being used. Hey, you know what? I think that's a four horseman. Let's write this out, or let's call Ken or whatever. You know, it's like no, that yeah. Let's reword that. That's really helpful because the other person, you know, just doesn't see it a lot of times. So you could agree on that, and it takes a while, you know. We'll put them on the fridge, and it takes like a while to get. But you'll just knowing about them helps, and we still mess up, you know, all the time, just not as much as we used to. We're more aware of them, and it really does help. So, anyway, so let's look at your packet now. This I want to thank Lindsay again for packing all these, putting all these together. This first thing here, it's called the Gottman Island Survival Game. All right, the Gottman Island Survival Game. And this first packet here, and these are tools that I use in counseling. And so, what's the purpose of this one? Well, first of all, what is it? Well, it's a game that you play, and you're basically shipwrecked on an island, and you have about 26 items on the boat that you could take with you, but you're only allowed to take 10 items. So you have a choice of 26 items, but you can only take 10 with you. And you have to decide together which of these 10 items you're going to take. And after you make your list, then you answer the questions. And what this does is it gauges how well you receive influence from each other. That's the whole point of this, how well you receive influence from each other. So you do the exercise, and then you gauge how well you received influence from each other. Now, guys, the husbands have a harder time receiving influence from their wives than the wives do from their husbands. That's one thing they found in the study. But in the case where couples did not receive, where at least one couple did not receive influence from the other person, those couples had an 80% failure rate. So receiving influence is very important in a relationship. And one of the things I'll tell guys is like, you know, because like, you know, God gave us wives to help us. You know, Eve's the helper, you know. You know, he put Adam to sleep, made a rib, you know, took it out of Adam and made Eve. You know, what does that tell us about guys? We're not all there. And we need help. And so he made Eve as a helper. And what I like to ask guys is, if you can't receive any influence from her, how in the world is she going to help you? She's not going to be able to help you if you cannot receive any influence. So that's the point of this, is how we receive influence from each other. And it's really fun to do. So check that out. The second thing here is a list of emotions. And what's this for? Well, sometimes you don't know where to start. And remember we said to complain instead of criticize, you have to talk about how you feel. And some couples can't get started because they don't know how they feel. So this is taken from the book Emotional Intelligence 2.0. Now, emotional intelligence, how many people have heard of emotional intelligence? Raise your hand. Good, awesome. It's it actually accounts for 85% of our success in life and in our careers. Our IQ only accounts for 15% of our success. So emotional intelligence is a very valuable thing to study and to know. Very helpful in marriage, very helpful in parenting. And by the way, for those of you parents or wannabe parents, avoiding the four horsemen and teaching your kids about this is one of the best things you could do to become a better parent and to raise kids and help them be successful in their relationships. And you could agree to make it a family thing to avoid these things. And you could train your kids, and then they could call out stuff that's not working. And you know, that's what we did. And our daughter helped us point out, hey, that's a four horseman, you know? And she's pretty good at it. Once in a while, I'll point them out with her, but she's better at it than we are. But she's actually studied this stuff more than we have. That's her field of expertise. But anyway, it's very great to talk about emotional intelligence. Most emotional intelligence is just basically self-awareness, self-management, and then social awareness and relationship management. It's got four steps to it. And it's really good to kind of know how you feel for a lot of reasons. One is you could say, okay, well, and there's high, medium, low. Basically, all five emotions are here: happiness, sadness, anger, fear, or shame. That's the categories of the five emotions that we're going to feel at any given time. And what's good is you can go, there's high, medium, and low. You go, you look for some word, go, okay, that's how I feel. And that's a starter for you to either journal or pray out loud to God, or talk to your spouse and say, I feel this way. And you could find a word in there, that's how I feel. And then it's a starter conversation to be able to start talking or praying or writing down or journaling. And so, it's good. Emotional intelligence, if you buy the book, you go online, take the assessment, and then you take it 6 months later as you work on it. And I actually did it, and I was lower than I thought I was. Lindsay wasn't surprised at my score, but at least I know what it is, and I'm working on it, and I'm in process, you know. But the important thing is that you know what it is, you're growing in it. I used to have two words to describe my emotions: stoked and bummed. That was the extent of my emotional intelligence. Now I've got some more words I can use in my vocabulary when I journal, you know. I'm probably up to like five, but how many words are there? Like 100 here. But, you know, as long as we're growing and we know about it. So, and that reminds you to talk about yourself before you talk about your spouse. You know, this is what I'm going through. This is how I'm feeling right now. And this is a very valuable tool for that. The second thing in your packet, or the third thing in your packet, is a little article taken from the book, The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work, which is where I got a lot of my lecture from. John Gottman, he's the author of that study. He's Jewish. He's a practicing Jew. Remember I said he was a mathematician at MIT. He also got a second PhD in psychology to be a research psychologist. He's not a therapist. He's a research psychologist. But this book is taken from their research. And like I said, everything I've found that works is biblical, and everything they found that doesn't work. In fact, there's one of the professors wrote a book. And I have it in my office, and it's the scriptures that support the study, and it's pretty thick, and there's just tons and tons. I've already found a ton, as you know, I shared some, but I could go all day talking about the scriptural basis for the stuff that really works, and it just makes sense. The Bible says every good and perfect gift comes from God, you know, so it totally makes sense. But anyway, so this is an article that, it's again, one of those things that's so interesting. This is an article about mother-in-laws. Okay, everybody fights over money, sex, kids, and in-laws, and household chores and jobs. And then I've also seen kind of an uptick in things affecting marriages over the last 10 years: grief, depression, and addictions as well. But so anyway, the in-law thing, the mother-in-law thing, that's what this article is about. And it's a scenario that you read it and you go, okay, that's what I need to do. Now, the Bible says in the Old Testament and the New Testament, a man, and it's repeated, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So I get a lot more concerned about the husband being too close to his mom than I do about the daughter being too close to her mom. Because it doesn't say anything to the daughter. It tells the man to leave and cleave. Because that's a necessary component. You have to have a sense of we-ness. You have to have to become your own entity. And if you don't do that, you know, there could be a lot of problems. And it doesn't matter how far you put your mom on the pedestal, as long as your wife's higher up. Your mom could be here and your wife needs to be here. Your mom could be here and your wife needs to be here. You know, it always has to be the number one spot. And that'll be tested if it's not. And this is a really good, interesting article about a scenario where a couple went through that and they learned how to do that. So leave and cleave, very important. That could be an issue, or it may not be an issue. Just depends on, I guess, where you've placed your wife in the relationship with respect to your mom. And it goes through a frustrating point in a person's life when they kind of had to learn that short article, two pages, quick and easy read. Not really important if you don't have that issue. This next one is called the five love languages. And I use this in premarital counseling and in marriage counseling as well. And what you do is there's 30 questions to answer. Okay, it's right here. It's the five love languages. There's 30 questions to answer. And you circle an X from each question. So the first question is, I like to receive notes of affirmation from you. I like it when you hug me. Okay, so there's two questions basically in number one. And then there's an X that corresponds to each of those statements. With each of these questions, you have to choose one. You get to circle one X from each box. So in other words, you have to sit there and go, okay, do I want a love note or do I want a hug? I want them both, but which one do I want more? Okay, so I want more. Okay, I want a hug. And so you circle this X. So you get to circle one X from each box, each category. And then when you add them up on the bottom on the third page, they should equal 30. But then it's also going to be the highest number in that bottom box after you circled all of the X's that you circled, after you added up all the, in each column, all the X's that you circled, you're actually going to get a higher number in one of these categories. So you're going to have either words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, or physical touch. Those are the five love languages that this will correspond to. One of them is going to be the highest for you. You may have two that are the highest together, and that's your bilingual. You have two love languages. My dog wants all five of these love languages. Cooper, he wants words of affirmation. He wants quality time. He wants gifts, bones, stuffed animals. He wants me to do things for him, take him for a walk, feed him, brush him, physical touch. He wants to be petted all the time. You know, he wants all five. And you know what? We want all five too. But there's something the way we're wired, and everybody's different. There's no right or wrong. But we're all wired in such a way where when someone does for us what's number one on our list, our highest love language, it registers, wow, they really love me. And it's important to know this because you want to work smarter, not harder, at the relationship. You don't want to be putting in a lot of effort where it doesn't really matter to them. I was in Serbia 25 years ago, right after NATO bombed the country, and I was there, and I was staying with this Serbian couple, and after about 2 days, I realized that they've actually speaking to each other in two different languages. I said, Luban, are you speaking a different language to your wife? He goes, oh yeah, I speak to her in Serbian. She speaks to me in Hungarian. I go, wow, your wife's Hungarian? He goes, oh yeah. And I was in Subotica, Serbia, which is right on the border of Hungary and Serbia. And I said, really? He goes, oh yeah, we all marry like Hungarian women. I go, why is that? Well, the Hungarians are a lot prettier than the Serbian women. So we go across the border and we meet them, and then we either stay there or they come over here. And because our countries border each other, we grow up learning each other's language. We understand it. And he goes, so I talked to her in Serbian, and she talks to me in Hungarian. And I said to him, do you ever speak to her in Hungarian? Because if you could understand it, you could speak it. And he goes, oh, once in a while, when I really want to get her attention, I'll speak to her in Hungarian. And I said, wow, that's interesting. I go, why don't you do it all the time? Well, it's not comfortable. It's awkward. It's not my own personal language. And I asked her the same thing. I said, do you speak to Luban? She goes, oh, yeah, I'll speak to him in Serbian when I really want to get his attention. I go, why don't you do it all the time? Well, it's awkward. It's not my own language. So if you come up with a different love language than your partner, it's going to be a little awkward. It's not your love language, but you have to learn to speak it. You have to actually do those things that are going to get your partner's attention and purposely do them. Maybe put this on the fridge. And write your name on and go, that's my number one love language. So remember it, because you'll forget, and then you have to be reminded and reminded and reminded. So it's better just to keep them on the fridge for a while and realize. And these are important. It's not just romantic relationships. This is important for everybody has a love language. It's important to know your kids' love language. Our daughter's love language is words of affirmation. So when we tell her You know, that you're a good Christian, you're a good child life specialist, you're a good friend, you're a good daughter. You know, you're good at this, you talk about their qualities. That makes them feel loved. And so it's really important to know what that is, to work smarter, not harder in the relationship. Because when you start off, at least, you do a lot of things that are not that important and wonder, they're not recognizing it. Maybe that's your love language. Maybe that's what you want. And so you turn around and do those things for your partner, and it doesn't matter to them. It doesn't register. It's not going to click and go, wow, they really love me. But if you do what's most important to them, physical touch, hand holding, back massages, head massage, feet massages, holding hands, just touching. And then acts of service, that's doing things for them, running errands for them, picking up the laundry, anything that they don't like to do themselves, carrying out the trash, that kind of thing. Receiving gifts, quality time, and then words of affirmation. Words of affirmation is affirming them, quality time and spending time together. So check that out. There's one for each of you on the five love languages. A really good book called The Five Love Languages, and that's where that came from. This next one is based upon a book, His Needs, Her Needs by Willard Harley. And usually when in premarital counseling, I'll fold this over. And by the way, I use this in premarital counseling a lot. I go, okay, these are the 10 things that all marriages need. This is true today. It's going to be true 1,000 years from now. This is true no matter what language you speak and no matter where you live in the world. These are 10 things that all marriages need. It's like a job description, you know? In other words, and so in premarital, I go, okay, size each other up. Do you think that they're going to meet all your needs? Because these are what they're going to be like 10 years from now. You're going to be looking for this list. Go, okay, something's missing. And you want to spend the rest of your life meeting their needs. And can you? Are you capable? And are they capable of meeting your needs? So it's kind of good to know what we're basically going to need. All right. And I say you need all 10 because you do. Every couple needs all 10 of these. And then I flip it over and I say, but most of the time, these are husband's needs. And most of the time, these are the wife's needs. But they all need all 10. I have some couples, maybe 20% of the couples I counsel, you could reverse this. So it's not like a straight down the line thing. And it depends on which stage you are in your marriage as well. But anyway, so for the guys, sexual fulfillment, physical attractiveness. Husbands want their wives to take as best care of themselves as they can. Men are obviously visual more than women or in different ways. The research shows that 25% of women are actually visual in the same way men are visual or in the same kind of way. Admiration, in other words, husbands want to kind of be admired, you know, hey, you're a good husband, you're a good worker, you're good that kind of a thing, respect kind of a thing. Recreational companionship, you know, we try to make buddies out of our wives because we don't have enough friends. The average woman has like 4 friends, the average guy has 1, it's his wife. If he loses her, he's out of luck, you know. So, but it's really important, you know, to guys, like if you surf, you want your wife to come down and be your surf chick and sit on the beach and watch you surf. And, you know, if you're into kayaking, you want to buy one for her to go kayaking and before you even ask her if she wants to go, you know. But this is something that kind of goes away fast when you first get married because, you know, I noticed that the girls really want to go to the Angels game and the Dodgers game and, you know, all that stuff. And then when they get married and maybe have kids, some of their interests change or whatever. They kind of want to do stuff with their girlfriends. And the guy's like, what, you used to do all this stuff? And, you know, so, but that's something, it's still a resonant, it's a need within guys, just that recreational companionship. If you're a Dodger fan, they want you to wear the jersey, tape the game, listen to you yell about the coach, you know, make the popcorn, go get the Dodger dogs, you know, and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's just something that whatever we're into, we want our wives to be into as well, kind of our hobby. We want to, like I said, kind of a buddy. And then domestic support, okay? To create a home, basically. 1950s, politics, sexual politics, kind of alive and well, a lot of families. The research shows that the guys do more around the house now than they did like 30 years ago. So, woo-hoo. So... and then her needs, affection. This would be non-sexual affection, not just leading up to and for the purpose of trying to get sex, but a standalone item, just straight up affection. Openness and honesty. They want to know what we're thinking and feeling and, you know, what's going on financially and everything in our world. Intimate conversation. This is interpersonal communication. The average couple has just under 2 minutes of interpersonal communication a day now. When you start off your relationship, you start off with a lot of interpersonal communication, talking about your feelings. And then it morphs.